It's Friday, June 17th. If they didn't think it was legal, why did they push Mike Pence to do it anyway? We start here. People close to the former vice president describe a vicious pressure campaign that could have reshaped American history.
Essentially, how they knew the theories that they were pushing actually weren't true.
The January 6th committee examines a legal theory meant to toss out an election. More than a year after most of us got access to vaccines, families of small children are finally ready for their turn.
This group of kids down to 6 months old is the last group that has not had access to the vaccine.
The CDC goes over data today. Shots could go into arms shortly after. We'll tell you what you should know. And it was overdue 150 years ago, but it's still the nation's youngest federal holiday.
It's important to live in Black joy, at least for the one day.
New perspectives on the past and future of Juneteenth. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. According to the House Select Committee on January 6th, its hearing earlier this week was about establishing one basic fact that people around President Trump understood the 2020 election was not stolen, that the big lie was, in fact, a lie. Well, yesterday, they held another hearing, and the purpose of this one was to establish how those people tried to force this lie onto Vice President Mike Pence.
The former president wanted Pence to reject the votes and either declare Trump the winner or send the votes back to the states to be counted again.
Remember, January 6th was not a randomly selected day for mayhem. This was the day, according to the Constitution, where each state presents their approved presidential votes. This process is overseen by the vice president. So to people who were convinced that states' tallies were fraudulent, this was a chance for Vice President Pence to say, actually, no, your tallies are illegitimate and they will not count. And think seriously for a second about what would have happened if Pence had done that, if he had unilaterally overruled the result of an election based on nothing but people's disproven suspicions. You're talking about a world where the courts would have to take sides, where government workers have to comply or not, where on January 20th, the military has a gut check about who their boss is, and meanwhile, in the streets, millions of Americans who voted for Joe Biden are now being told the winner won't be sworn in. You really think the chaos will be limited to one city?
We would have established a situation where a vice president would have asserted that one person could have the authority to determine the outcome of an election.
And that's why this testimony about Mike Pence had its own day, because for the future of this country, this was perhaps the moment on January 6th that mattered most. ABC's Catherine Falders was in that committee room during this hearing. She joins us from the Capitol now. And Catherine, can you just walk me through what you heard here?
Yeah. So look, the theme of yesterday's hearing was all about this pressure campaign on Mike Pence. We heard from a retired federal judge, Michael Luttig. He was also an informal advisor to Pence.
I would have laid my body across the road before I would have let the vice president overturn the 2020 election.
And then we also heard from Pence's lawyer, top lawyer in the White House, Greg Jacob, who was behind the scenes writing all of these memos, dealing with the lawyers on the outside, essentially saying that the vice president can't just unilaterally decide who the president of the United States was.
Our review of text, history, and frankly, just common sense all confirmed the vice president's first instinct on that point. There is no justifiable basis to conclude that the vice president has that kind of authority.
The beginning of the hearing talked all about this lead up to January 6th.
Did the vice president ever waver in his position that he could not unilaterally decide which electors to accept?
The vice president never budged from the position that I have described as his first instinct.
The second part of the hearing really focused on the day of January 6th.
We were told that a call had come in from the president. The vice president stepped out of the room to take that call, and no staff went with him.
This was obviously when Pence was announcing his decision that he disagreed with Trump at the time.
The conversation was pretty heated.
Do you remember what she said? Her father called him
the P word.
And what happened after that. So when Pence was in the Capitol, until obviously he came back early the next morning to announce that President Biden was, in fact, declared the president-elect.
And so in this pressure campaign, as they were describing it, I mean, what were the most compelling pieces of testimony?
So they essentially showed how a lot of these lawyers who were behind these fringe legal theories, John Eastman, one you heard a lot about, this Trump lawyer who was on the outside, essentially how they knew the theories that they were pushing actually weren't true.
When I pressed him on the point, I said, John, if the vice president did what you were asking him to do, we would lose 9-0 in the Supreme Court, wouldn't we? And he initially started it, well, I think maybe you would lose only 7-2. And after some further discussion, acknowledged, well, yeah, you're right. We would lose 9-0.
And what was remarkable is you remember that statement that Donald Trump released the day before January 6th, so January 5th, where he said that the vice president and I are in, we agree on this, right, that Pence has the authority to do this. Well, we heard from the two witnesses and from some of the witnesses who were pre-recorded that they were shocked and horrified that Trump would say such a thing, that was just not the case behind the scenes.
Was it your impression that the vice president had directly conveyed his position on these issues to the president, not just to the world through a dear colleague letter, but directly to President Trump?
Many times.
And he'd been consistent in conveying his position to the president?
Very consistent.
Okay.
So they really showed and painted this picture of a theories that behind the scenes were known to have been illegal. John Eastman, one of those also Trump election lawyers, was out there pushing these theories, even though everybody around them was telling him that this wasn't true.
And I said to him, hold on a second, I want to understand what you're saying. You're saying that you believe the vice president, acting as president of the Senate, can be the sole decision maker as to, under your theory, who becomes the next president of the United States? And he said, yes. I said, are you out of your effing mind?
And it was revealed during the hearing, Brad, that John Eastman, actually in the days after January 6th, wrote to Rudy Giuliani.
Dr. Eastman's email stated, quote, I've decided that I should be on the pardon list, if that is still in the works.
Acknowledgement that he thinks that there was some wrongdoing associated with January 6th. So you have all of these characters. Another name that's now come into the fold is Ginni Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. She was also on emails with John Eastman discussing the election and how to overturn the election. The committee says now they want to hear from Ginni Thomas, and Ginni Thomas told the Daily Caller, a conservative publication, that she would like to talk to the committee and she wants to clear up any misrepresentations.
And this was a moment where you had both Republicans and Democrats praising Mike Pence for essentially being the guy that stood between January 6th and something that would be much, much worse than just one day in this country's history. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, there are toddlers who have spent their whole lives in a pandemic, and they might finally be ready for a vaccine. That's after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The vote is unanimous. We have 21 out of 21 yes votes.
This could be a big weekend for parents in this pandemic, because a couple days ago, FDA advisors recommended for the very first time that children under 5 can take a COVID vaccine.
My child is still young. She's 7 months old, but as soon as the vaccine is approved and recommended, I will definitely vaccinate her.
Later today, the CDC will consider whether to sign off on these vaccines as well. Sony Salzman is with the ABC News Medical Unit. Sony, it looks like this could finally happen, right? Like, when could shots conceivably go in arms here?
Yeah, thanks, Brad. So this is a really exciting moment in the vaccine rollout. This group of kids down to 6 months old is the last group that has not had access to the vaccine. And in terms of a timeline, the CDC and its advisors are meeting today. We expect that the vote is going to come in tomorrow. That's Saturday. Then if the vote is positive, vaccines could ship out over the weekend, and we could see shots in arms as early as Tuesday, because Monday is that holiday.
Right. FDA, then CDC advisors, then that goes to Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC. She would still have to sign off. But assuming that happens, Sony, this is two vaccines we're talking about, right? There's Pfizer and there's Moderna. Are there differences between them? Like, is there anything for parents to consider if suddenly they both become available?
Yeah, you know, generally speaking, what pediatricians tell us is that they want choice. Choice is good.
Both vaccines are safe, the Pfizer and the Moderna. We know that they both produce a very good, strong immunological response, which is really important.
Now, throughout the entire pandemic, Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, they use the same technology. They've been pretty lockstep, right? There's minor differences between them, but they've been pretty similar. When you get down to this age group, there actually are differences that it's important for parents to know. So the Pfizer vaccine is going to be given as 3 shots, and the Moderna vaccine is going to be given as 2 shots. Now, the reason that that is the case is because Pfizer went down to a very low dose, 1/10 of the adult dose. And when they gave the vaccine as 2 shots in those studies, they just didn't see enough efficacy that they were hoping for. So if you're a parent and you opt to vaccinate your kid with Pfizer, it is really important that you go back for that third dose.
There has been some controversy in some states, Sony. Like in Florida, the official state government line, I believe, is that healthy kids should not be injected with these vaccines. The state itself hasn't bought a supply of these dosages. So I'm wondering, will every parent who wants a vaccine for their kid be able to get one if they become available?
Yeah, you know, that's tricky. And I think that problems like access to vaccines are going to hopefully have less to do with the state that you live in and the leadership decisions that are made in that state, and more to do with, you know, how far away from the pharmacy you are, those sort of traditional challenges.
Doctors can get it, hospitals can get it, but there's not going to be any state programs that are going to be trying to, get COVID jabs to infants and toddlers and newborns. That's not something that we think is appropriate. And so that's not where we're going to be utilizing our resources in that regard.
When it comes to Florida and this issue of do kids need to be vaccinated and some of the kind of decisions that have been made there, I do think sometimes we're working with an incongruous premise here.
We have seen more than, and specifically in this age group, more than 30,000 hospitalizations and more than 400 deaths, making COVID more harmful for children under 5 than any outbreak of the flu in the last decade.
While it is true that COVID is way less deadly for children compared to adults, more kids still die of COVID than, for example, the flu. And we have no problem vaccinating our children against the flu. So, you know, if these vaccines are recommended by Dr. Walensky of the CDC, as we expect them to be, you know, it is going to be strongly recommended, and parents are going to be strongly encouraged to go get their kids vaccinated.
And you would take that, like, you just take them to the local pharmacy, like the Walgreens or something like that?
It depends on where you are, but I do think that for this vaccine rollout, it is going to be a little different. You have to remember that for this age group, they're much younger children. Some of them cannot articulate things like I hurt or I have a fever. So this vaccine rollout is actually going to be more reliant on your pediatrician. Call your pediatrician, schedule those appointments. You know, sometimes, depending on how young a child is, you might get a shot in the thigh instead of in the arm. So really, parents are going to be urged to call their pediatricians and access these vaccines through those offices versus bringing your kid to a CVS or a Walgreens and kind of plunking them down on the countertop there.
Just sticking them there. Here, give them the shot, please, right here. All right, really helpful, Sony Salzman. And again, this all is contingent on more approvals, but thus far, we've seen a lot of these approvals follow each other one after the other. Thanks a lot, Sony.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it.
This Sunday is June 19th. Juneteenth, which you might remember was declared a federal holiday just last year.
There'll be a few parades. I try to make sure that I attend everybody's cookouts because we like to eat.
Juneteenth is about Black joy, and it's important to live in Black joy, at least for the one day.
It'll be marked by millions of Americans this Sunday, then observed by workplaces on Monday. But compared to other holidays like Thanksgiving or the 4th of July, lots of Americans haven't really settled on their tradition of Juneteenth, right? They think of it more as a concept, not necessarily as a specific event to remember. They might think of it as marking the end of slavery, but maybe not of a June day in Texas, where long after the Emancipation Proclamation was delivered, enslaved people were finally told they were free. But perhaps nothing spells out that history better than what happened after that day on June 19th, 1865. Because for many Black Americans, that was really the beginning of a brand new opportunity to form new Black communities in this country. They were called freedom colonies. And one of the foremost experts on American freedom colonies is our next guest. Andrea Roberts is a professor at Texas A&M. She's the director of the Texas Freedom Colonies Project. And Professor, you can actually trace your own lineage back to some of these areas, right?
Yes, I can. I can trace my family lineage back to historic African-American settlements in several counties in Texas.
And so what were freedom colonies?
Yeah, they're known by so many different names. So, you know, some people call them freedmen settlements, or they call them historic Black settlements. But what all of these names are describing are intentionally created Black communities. When we think about Black communities, we often have the idea of a place that's within an inner city, that is urban, and that is a place that African Americans were in some way forced to live or live by default. Whereas these communities that were created 1865 to 1930, generally speaking, are communities where you had landowners, you know, early African-American landowners who lived together in clusters for safety and sustained themselves independently, often in very secluded areas and rural areas throughout Texas.
When I was a little boy, I was a little country school, and I enjoyed going along with friends, talking and laughing, going to and from school.
And so you have a period of time in which, you know, African Americans are legally free, but they still are experiencing all of the restrictions around movement. They're stigmatized.
I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home.
They're living under threat of constant violence.
I still see Black men seeing being shot, Black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fog.
So it was so critical for them to create these communities because that's where they would be safe. Because if they visibly, they made it apparent that they owned land, they made it apparent that they accumulated any type of capital, then they would attract white resentment. And that spelled vigilante violence, right? So, you know, these are not, you know, idyllic, perfect communities, but they were places of refuge.
Part of your work with the Texas Freedom Colonies Project is creating an atlas for these places, like a map. You say there are a total of 500 just across Texas. You're working on locating and documenting all of them. What you've told me so far is fascinating. Why haven't these places existed on official state maps before, though?
Well, for one, we don't orient ourselves, right, to these places anymore. We live in more urban areas. But also, you had a number of these communities that were never thought of to be a community.
Until the mid-50s, Joppe was its own. I think at that point is when the city really starts to see the asset and grab it and say, oh, it's going to be part of Dallas now.
When they were mapped, they were maybe mapped as part of a county, or they were informally known as this area. Or there's a church that carries the name of that settlement, and that's how we can still recognize or see evidence of a place.
They definitely dip snuff, chew tobacco,
So therefore, when they would say Jaffe, it was Joppy. Joppy, I stay in Joppy, you know, and people kept saying that until they come up with J-O-P-P-Y, J-O-P-P-I-E, and now it's J-O-P-P-E-E.
We have oral history, we have memory that tell us that they were whole intentional communities.
I think just returning to the land is something that is going to spiral into a melding of love, concern, and care that you just don't get in the city. And it wasn't until I was an adult, but I was able to go down home.
My initial work was in an area of Texas called Shankleville, and it's in Newton, Texas, which is on the border between Texas and Louisiana. And for that community, their origin story is what actually makes that community live. Jim and Winnie Shankle were enslaved in Mississippi, and Winnie was sold away to a master in Texas. Jim swam several great rivers to reunite with her there in Shankleville at a spring. And the relationship between the ways in which that community retells the story every year at an annual homecoming, every 2 years at a reunion, in the place where their ancestors are said to have reunited when separated. They retell this story at the spring, at a church near the spring, to commemorate that origin story.
To me, Shankleville is it's a symbol of my family. This is where most of my family for generations has grown up. And when I come back here, I just get a real sense of family and tradition. And I can see how my family as a whole has become what it is.
So this sense of their beginnings draws people from all over Texas and all over the world who draw their lineage back to Jim and Winnie Shankle in some way, shape, or form.
What I find inspirational about what you just said, too, is you were just talking about the story of reunification between two people.
Yes.
And that site where that happened is now a place where, like, a whole community and its descendants can reunite year after year.
Yes. And what's significant to my work, what I think differentiates it maybe from all the historians who do this work, is I'm interested in what those stories and that sense of place makes people do in the presence to save and protect that community from destruction and from erasure.
Well, and that seems like such an opportunity for the nation at large, right? As Americans start to mark this new federal holiday every year with just such specific stories that we can reflect on together and share. Andrea Roberts from Texas A&M, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me, and happy Juneteenth.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, what is the future of our youngest holiday? A special one last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. It's worth remembering that Juneteenth is not taking place in a vacuum. By nature, it is a day that is based in race and social justice, and frankly, the most basic form of politics. Who counts? Whose voice gets heard? And because of that, everyone interprets a day like June 19th in their own way. So we're going to do something a little different for this final segment today. We invited Kelly Carter Jackson, a professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, to re-examine this essay she wrote for The Atlantic last year for the first federal recognition of this holiday. And in a special effort for Start Here, she has updated that essay for 2022. Here it is now.
When you are Black in America,
How do you celebrate progress? How do you honor the history and memory of emancipation, liberation, and advancement? How do you mark a moment when a positive change transformed the trajectory of your life, your nation? For many Black Americans, that moment has been Juneteenth, or June 19th, the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, received word that they were free, some 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation had taken effect. When I think about Juneteenth, I'm mostly stuck on that delay, the time it took for more than 250,000 enslaved Texans to experience what some 3 million other formerly enslaved Americans already had: freedom. Texan planters had long known that the Civil War was over. They had just hoped to get one more harvest out of their human property. And this country, hiding history, has always been about maintaining control, denying concession, and delaying justice. In my years of work as a historian, I have found that the public usually uses history and memory interchangeably, though they are not the same. History is immovable. Memory is malleable. I'm constantly thinking about how to reconcile history and memory, the past with the present, and symbolic changes with systemic ones. It is impossible to celebrate Juneteenth and simultaneously deny the teaching of Americans' foundational legacy, push to observe a holiday at a federal level, and at the same time ban curricula focused on slavery's lasting effects. Holidays, like memories, are chosen. They are collective social agreements employed to acknowledge an event or a person, and the observation of a holiday is usually distanced from the full history that compelled it. Though Black folks have honored their ancestors in meaningful ways on Juneteenth for more than a century, to many non-Black citizens, it marks a day off from work and little else. But holidays cannot be divorced from history. Choosing to remember palatable histories over painful histories serves no one. It merely fosters fantasy. Instead, why don't we choose to use Juneteenth as a day to move forward toward new futures by registering voters, reimagining policing in our communities, and pushing elected officials to carry out the work of reparations? If Americans fight to make sure history and critical thinking are integral parts of the classroom experience, students can use that knowledge to change the trajectory of society. At the end of his life, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "This is a beautiful world. This is a wonderful America, which the founding fathers dreamed until their sons drowned it in the blood of slavery and devoured it in greed." But Du Bois was also hopeful, adding, "Our children must rebuild it." To do this, our past cannot be denied. Acknowledging it is crucial to rethinking and rebuilding a more perfect union. As long as our holidays are unaccompanied by learning or relearning, superficial symbols will remain the dominant markers of memory, absent of history.
And our thanks to Kelly Carter Jackson for creating that audio essay with us. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas Baker, Lewis Millman, Madeline Wood, Vika Aronson, Iru Ekpanobi, and Tara Gimble. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is our podcast manager. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is the head of ABC Audio. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, and our intern, Ania McLean. Special thanks this week to the Cultural Landscape Foundation, Clay History and Education Services, and Kirshen Jones Studios for their remarkable sound they provided from these former Texas freedom colonies, along with ABC's Arthur Jones II, Chris Berry, and Armando Garcia. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.